He came from happy but humble beginnings right here in Knoxville and ended up on a major label with dozens of songs in the top 40 country charts, hanging out with Chet Atkins, touring the country with George and Tammy, playing at the White House. But before that, he lit up the Knoxville music scene with standing room only crowds at the Village Barn and the Corner Lounge. Lots of folks, including my sisters, still talk about those shows, and some of his fans still swoon at the very mention of his name, Con Hunley.
Take it easy, loving me. And here's the woman who's cried herself.
Con Hunley came down to WUOT back in August, and we sat down for a long-ranging talk, going back to his very earliest years, attending the midday merry-go-round, and then off to Nashville. At some point, we end up in South Africa with Big John Tate. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. Con, welcome to WUOT. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Todd. How about you?
I feel pretty happy.
I do, too. I'm glad to be alive and still able to sing and pick and grin and do what I've done for my entire life.
Does anybody call you Conrad at all anymore?
Well, actually, my name is Connard. I come from a long line of illiterates. That was a family name that was passed down. I think it was a last name at some point in time. And so my grandfather on my mother's side, his name was Milburn Connard Brewer. And my grandfather on my dad's side, his name was Logan. So Connard Logan Hunley. And so we were named after, I was named after both grandfathers. And my sister Beth, who was born 2 years after I was born, was named after the grandmother's. Her name is Elizabeth Fair. So that's kind of odd and different, but but that's my name.
When'd you go from Connard to Con?
Well, I think as a youngster, my mother got tired. You know, we played outside, we played rough, and there was all kinds of wooded areas out where I was raised, out off of Greenway Drive at the time. It was before the interstates and all that stuff, and there was a big farm. It was the Hedrick Farm, and we used to play up in the woods and the fields, and my mother would, I could hear her holler, "Connard," you know. And so I think over time she just kind of shortened it and said, "Connard." So that's my memory of that, and of course it kind of stuck, and all my aunts and uncles and cousins started calling me Con, and that's it just stuck.
What was it like growing up in those days in Knoxville? You were out near Fountain City, right?
Well, I was actually on Beverly, at the time it was called Beverly Road, where it turned off of Tazewell Pike and went up to what they call the overhead bridge at Washington Pike. And I lived closer to the overhead bridge at Washington Park than I did Fountain City. But it was great. I mean, we didn't have anything, you know. I was born in a little old house right there on Greenway Drive. And then we moved when I was probably maybe 6 or 7 years old, about a block and a half away on a little old lane. It was a cinder lane called Mack Lane, and lived there for a while. We didn't have indoor plumbing. I remember having to carry water from a well, 5 gallon buckets, and we did have electricity though. And of course we had wood-fired, coal-fired stoves, that we used, but it was great. I mean, everybody in that area was poor. They didn't have a whole lot of stuff. There were a couple of families, probably a little more fortunate than ours, but for the most part, we were all just alike, and we didn't see any difference in anybody, and we certainly didn't get around enough to make any comparison as to who had what and who didn't, everybody played and sang, and our relatives would get together on you know, Saturday night, and they were great musicians, and we'd sit around and play and sing, and I'd just sit there and watch them and pat my foot and clap my hands, you know. And I was probably 12 years old before I realized everybody didn't play an instrument, you know, because both sides of my family was musical.
You got a gift for music, period, but your singing gift is exceptional. Was there someone else in your family that just had those kind of pipes?
All of them sang, and they could sing harmony, and to my knowledge, none of them ever had any formal musical training. It was all by ear. But my uncles on my mother's side, her brothers, were extremely, exceptionally talented. One of them could play, and I'm talking about playing. I'm not just talking about picking out a few tunes, you know. He played the fiddle. He could rock a piano off stage. He could play guitar. He was a great songwriter. He was a great singer. His name was Olin Brewer. And then my other uncle, his brother, Jim Brewer, was a great guitar player. And my uncle, Bo Brewer, was a great mandolin player, great banjo player, guitar player. And they were all great singers. That was kind of before amplification. They didn't have any microphones or anything like that. So they had to learn to project, you know, and I call beller. They had to learn, you know, and they were great, you know, and people on my father's side were not quite as musically talented, but, you know, Dad played, he played clawhammer banjo, guitar, he sang, and my mother played guitar and piano, and so everybody in the family played. As far as what you call pipes, I don't know. I mean, all of them can sing. My mother had a sister. Her name was Lita Rose. She had some pipes. She could sing. And she was kind of in the Mahalia Jackson mode. You know, she did gospel music, and she would throw her head back. And if God couldn't hear, he missed a great chance to hear. I'm telling you that, because she would let it fly. And it was great. It was just fabulous, very spiritual, very touching, you know, very moving.
What kind of music were you listening to as a kid growing up? Were you listening to things on the radio, or were you mostly just entertaining yourselves?
Well, you know, basically early on it was gospel music. You know, we were raised in the Church of God church, and it was foot stomping, hand clapping music. And in fact, early on we used to go to black churches around the University Avenue area and over in there early on. And I guess that's where we got our appreciation for kind of that music that comes from down deep within, you know. And so it was basically gospel music, but I always loved to listen to the stylists, people who, when you heard them, you knew who they were. You recognized the voice, you recognized the instrument. My first hero was Chet Atkins. I mean, I wanted to be a thumb style guitar player, and I remember I got a guitar when I was 9 years old, and of course it was a used Stella guitar, and the strings were about an inch off the neck. Trying to get sound out of it wasn't easy, but I remember learning to play the Wildwood Flower and Windy and Warm, Chet Atkins, you know. Somewhere along the line, Chet got the idea to record Dixie and Yankee Doodle Dandy at the same time, and somehow that kind of discouraged me because I couldn't I couldn't play it. He could play both of them at the same time. It was unbelievable. I like Jerry Lee Lewis. It's just that rocking piano. I love Charlie Rich. I was a huge fan of Ray Charles. I mean, Ray Charles could just, I don't know, he just sang from the pits of his soul. And that's That's really what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to convey with my music, you know.
You said you switched to piano. Was it your sister that had the piano, Beth?
Yeah. And Beth is a great singer. I mean, I'm forcing him. My entire family sang, you know. And, of course, when I went on the road and started traveling quite a bit initially, I couldn't take them because I couldn't afford them. Could barely afford a wake-up knock at the Motel 6, you know. We didn't have a telephone. We had those little small black and white TVs, you know, and we always kidded about not getting a wake-up call, but a wake-up knock. But, you know, eventually I was forced enough to be able to take Ruth and Tim and Kenny on the road. Of course, they, all my recordings after 2010, they were all on. But they're all great singers, but my folks bought Beth a piano so she could accompany all of us in church when we sang. We had guitars. They thought piano would be great. So they bought a piano, and it was an old upright piano, used piano, naturally. There was a neighborhood, a guy in the neighborhood who could play and read, and he was going to give her lessons. And he did. They started doing the lessons. Well, when, you know, at about this time, I think it was like 1960, 61, Ray Charles came out with a song called What Did I Say? And that intro just lit me on fire, you know. And so when she wasn't on the piano taking lessons, I'm over here with the hunting pick, you know, trying to learn the intro to this What Did I Say? And that really is what kind of got me interested in learning to play the piano. I never did have any lessons or anything like that. Couldn't read a note of music, and still can't for that matter.
Did you get a chance when you were growing up to see Chet Atkins, to see Charlie Pride, to see Ray Charles when you were in that formative age?
I got to see Jerry Lee Lewis at the Indian Rock over on Rutledge Park when I was very young. There was a Georgia and Raymond Brady owned that Indian Rock, and I'd gotten acquainted with her through a cousin of mine who knew her and told her how much I liked, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis and all that. And I was too young to go in the place, but sweet talked her, and she said, "Will you bring him on and we'll find a place for him to sit?" So he took me in there, and I sat back in a corner booth, and Jerry Lee just knocked it out of the park, you know. Of course, Jerry Lee was Jerry Lee. I mean, he just rocked it. And so I got a chance to see him, which was really neat. And, you know, when I was a kid, I used to go to the midday merry-go-round with my mother. We would catch a school bus after the school runs, you know, other than the school buses would come through communities and take people downtown. And I would, we'd go walk up to the overhead bridge on Washington Pike and catch the bus and go downtown. And she would always try to get there before the midday merry-go-round. And I got to see a lot of people playing and sing there. And I was, you know, very young. I mean, I probably maybe 5, 6, 7 years old or something like that. Certainly younger than school age, or I wouldn't have been there. I'd been in school. But I remember it. But what's really been great is through the years, you know, talking about Chet Atkins and Ray Charles, Charlie Rich, Jerry Lee, I eventually got acquainted with them, got to play with them, got to open for Ray Charles a couple of times, I think maybe 3 times. Let him know, was able to talk to him, let him know how much I appreciate his music, how much I, you know, there was a picture of me, he and I together, and I had a bead on him, you know, and it's like I was I wanted him to see me, you know, how much I cared about him, how much I loved his music. But got a chance to get acquainted with Chet. I mean, it was just how everything worked out. I got to play with a lot of Charlie Rich. I got to do, in fact, the last TV show he did We got to do a duet together. And so it was just amazing when you stop and think about the kid from 4412 Mike Lane out off Greenway Drive who had the dream, all this music and everything, and eventually, over a number of years, getting to meet your heroes and sing with them, play with them, and all that stuff. It's just, you know, it's when you stop and think about it, it's pretty amazing.
It's kind of amazing in a sense because you obviously were consumed by music from a very young age, and you had the gift, and then you joined the Air Force.
Well, it's either and or, okay? When Uncle Sam sends you a little letter and says your number is up, you have to make a decision. That's back during the draft, you know. And so I'd just gotten out of high school and went to work. My father worked at Standard Knitting Mill for, I think, like 47 years. But anyway, that's where he was working when I got out of school, like father, like son. I had to live. I certainly couldn't live off music, especially at that age. I started to work at the Standard Knitting Mill, and of course, believe it or not, during this time, right after I got out of high school, started to work at Standard Knitting Mill, I managed to get to go back to the Indian Rock, and there was a band playing there, Gene Hammock and his band. He'd been around for a long time, great singer, sort of in the vein of
Eddie Arnold kind of a thing.
Yeah. And anyway, she snuck me in and she wanted me to hear the band. Well, it so happened that the piano player didn't show up that night. Well, it also just happened that I knew about five songs, and the ones that I knew, I knew. As it turned out, when his piano player didn't show up, well, Georgie says, well, we've got a kid right back here. He plays piano and he sings, of course, like I said, five or six songs. But anyway, I got up there and I played the five or six songs with the band that I knew, and I rocked them, you know. Well, I got a job. The guy says, what are you doing tomorrow night? Gene Hammock. He said, I'm playing the Eagles Club downtown, and I'd love for you to come and play with us. Well, I didn't tell him I was only five songs I knew. Anyway, I went to Robert Hall. I bought me a $52 suit. And I dressed up that Saturday night, and I went to the Eagles Club, went in there and sat down, and played my five songs, you know, with the band, and they played great with me and all that stuff. And then when it came time for me to play with them, I didn't know anything they were playing. Didn't know the keys. So I figured Gene would say, well, what kind of deal is this, you know? But he didn't. He kind of took me under his wing, and he was very patient with me, and I was able to go to rehearsals after that, and they worked with me. Jack Cunningham played guitar. He was a Chet-type player, thumb-style player. So they really just, you know, took their time with me, and I started to learn all the songs and all that stuff. So I played at the Eagles Club. I'll never forget it. My first night, that Saturday night, I made $12, and I was making $1.41 an hour at the Standard Dentonville. Comparatively, I was making a lot of money, you know, like for 3 hours or 4 hours, whatever it was, from 8 to 12 because they had to close at 12 o'clock. So I thought I was, you know, I thought I was rocking and rolling at that time, $12 a night. And then, of course, as I mentioned, I got the notice from the military and subsequently joined the Air Force. I'd always been mechanically inclined, and so I wanted to try to learn some sort of trade. Especially having to do with aircraft, because I knew it paid good money if the music thing didn't work out. I joined the Air Force, and I gave them 4 years of my life, and I was able to play while I was in the Air Force. When I was in tech school at Chanute, Illinois, it was all as Air Training Command, so you had to be spit-shined and polished. And of course, I was a gung-ho recruit. I mean, I went to what they call rope school, which is really drill instructor school. And I was a barracks commander and all that stuff. And I remember I was so gung-ho that everything was starched and creased and pleated. And I used to get saluted because people would think I was an officer. And I wasn't. every first, second class. But I was able to play. When I got transferred to California, I got to play with a band. They were a traveling band, and they came to this place in Atwater, California, that was called the Empire Lounge. And I used to go there, and I got a chance to work with them, and that's really when the bug bit me. I mean, bit me big time.
Do you find that what you learned in the military in some ways really helped you as a performer, as a professional musician? Like, did you get into, like, you know, regiment and schedules and getting tasks done? Like that piano player that never showed up.
Right.
Right. He probably wouldn't have done well in the Air Force either.
No, he may not have. you know, it was an air training command when I was in Rantoul, Illinois, and it was strict. I mean, it was real strict, and you had to be disciplined, you know. And then, I got pulled out of when I went to tech school. That's just when the Vietnam War had begun to escalate. Some of my buddies were going to Vietnam. I wanted to go to Vietnam with them. And they came to me, my superiors came to me and said, well, we need you here more than we need you over there. We want you to be an instructor. So they pulled me right after I graduated from tech school. They sent me to instructor training, and I taught aircraft pneumatics and hydraulics for probably for almost 2 years. And I wound up not going to be. But I do think the discipline that you mentioned is a big part of it. I mean, when I started learning to play and when I really got the bug, I was consumed by it, you know. And as I mentioned earlier, I never had any formal training, didn't know how to read music or whatever. So, you know, I could hear it, and then I'd go find it, you know. And then it's like rote, you know. You have to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it so that it becomes second nature because you can't read it, you know. And so that's what I did. And I'm sure I drove a lot of people right up the walls. I remember when I was learning to play What Did I Say? I can't count the times they would say, Connor, get off the piano, you know, because I was driving there. But, I loved it. And so the same thing, and learning all these songs and playing with these bands and what have you, I just take a certain discipline.
Con and a friend got an early release, and he moved down to L.A., didn't see many movie stars. Didn't do so much in music, and then found his way back to Knoxville around 1969. So when you came back to Knoxville, at that point, you'd been gone quite a while. Do you feel like the city had changed, or you had changed?
Well, all the above. You know, I was kind of a stranger in my hometown, you know. You know, I didn't, of course, I wanted to play music, and, of course, I had the music bug, And by this time, I knew quite a few songs that I could play and had memorized and all that. But, you know, I didn't know anybody. I mean, I knew my family, and a lot of people had grown up and left, and just didn't know a whole lot of people. So it was kind of difficult readjusting, especially coming from L.A. to Knoxville in 1969, February of 69. You know, on the way to work, you had to allow an hour and a half, 2 hours to get there and 2 or 3 hours to get home, you know, traffic-wise. And here it was like everything was a five-minute trip, you know. It was a little different. And I had a couple of friends. One of my friends, Jerry Buehler, who was a great friend of mine, he was in the Navy, and he was a little older than I was, but he'd gotten out, and he was home, and he and I kind of reconnected, and we just happened to walk in the Corner Lounge over here one night, and as they say, the rest is history.
The Corner Lounge, which is still there. I mean, it goes away, and it comes back. It goes away, it comes back.
It's like a country singer. You can't kill one of them. You just can't kill the Corner Lounge. It was something else. I remember going in there the first time we went in. And there was two or three friends with us, and we were out just kicking around, you know, and they had a piano, a little piano bar, and I sat down and started playing. this happened several times over, say, a period of 3 or 4 weeks, you know. And, we'd go in one night out every week, every 2 weeks or whatever, and I'd sit down and play. Well, people were enjoying it, and finally the lady known the thing said, well, if you're going to be coming over here, you know, we probably need to make a deal. I started playing there on Thursday nights for beer and tips, and did it for the better part of 10 years.
People started paying attention and enjoying the music of Con Hunley at the Corner Lounge. Well, most people. He does tell stories about playing a song, and then in the middle of the song, someone goes to the jukebox and puts on something. He would just stop playing, wait for the song to finish on the jukebox, and finish the song he was playing originally.
Did they have food?
They did.
What did they have?
Initially, it was called the Corner Grill, okay? And she didn't think Corner Grill sounded cool enough, so she changed the name to the Corner Lounge. But they served, like, sandwiches and pizza and stuff like that, you know, not any steaks or, you know, any meat and threes and all that. It's mostly sandwiches.
You know, 1969, in 68, 69, there was a big, obviously, explosion in rock music going on at that period. And were you incorporating any of that and also a lot of incredible R&B in those times? Were you singing mostly country things, or were you picking a little of everything?
Well, I tried to sing. I mean, I was fortunate that I could sing pretty much anything, you know. But basically, I stayed with country music, and all my country had a little blues fringe to it, you know. It was gray around the edges, you know. And I've had such a great appreciation for R&B and blues and stuff like that. And as I mentioned before, you know, I always took to the stylist. I admired stylists so much. And the reason I did is because I just felt what they played and what they sang, you know. And so when I'd sing a country song, it would come out a little bluesy. I mean, I'd either slow it down or maybe rearrange it a little bit or what have you. But at that time, there's a lot of people who were playing locally around that time said, why don't you get a rock band? Why don't you do this and all that? Well, that was fine and dandy, but country music was paying the bills, you know. But I loved country music. I loved the simplicity of the lyrics, the songs, the attitude. But I hear it different. I try to interpret it in a way to where the people can feel it. They think you've been where you're talking about, where you're singing about. And there's a lot of people, a lot of guys got on me, but I stuck with it and toughed it out and managed to get a job with the Rhythm Masters. A friend of mine, Marvin Russell, who's a great guitar player, thumb style guitar player, he had a group called the Rhythm Masters. And Sam Roberts had the Village Barn, and it was a huge place. And a guy, Jim Baldwin, who passed not long ago, but he used to come to the corner and hear me play. He said, you know, Sam Roberts got the Village Barn up here. You need to go up here and talk to him or talk to his band leader or whatever. That's where you need to be playing. And so I went up and talked to Sam and Marvin and managed to get a job with them playing Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. So I had Wednesday, Thursday at the corner, Friday, Saturday at the barn. And it wasn't long till we were really packing them in at the barn. I mean, it was nothing for us to have 600, 700, maybe even 1,000 people on Saturday night. It was something else. And I played there for the better part of 10 years.
And that's, you know, that's almost like 10% of Knoxville.
Yeah, at the time.
Well, this is where the story really takes off, and this is where we're going to take a break. Stay tuned for part 2 of our interview with Con Hunley as part of Raised in Knoxville. a production of WUOT. I'm Todd Steed.
Woman drive a big fine foreign car to get diamond rings. But when she wants her man at night,